So just to really kind of highlight on one particular point, which Rabbi Willig discusses particular focus in the Sefer. So we've been talking about distinctions between liquids and solids as far as the premise that we have of any bishul achar bishul, that the prohibition of bishul will not begin anew if you have an item that was already cooked. And is there a distinction, lahalacha, between solids and liquids? And if there is a distinction to be made, is it across the board? Or do different liquids have different issues associated with them? And what I'd like to focus on today is the question of how do you define something as a liquid versus a solid? And particularly through the prism of one particular chiluk that exists, one particular svar al-chalik b'neim, that we saw a little bit of this last week, that it's possible that the distinction is not necessarily only about whether there is a physical change, or whether the definition of liquids in terms of cooking, the definition of cooking rather than in terms of liquids is just temperature as opposed to other things, but also the possibility that liquids and solids are generally different because there is this edibility factor, that when you have something that's cooked, food that's cooked, solid food that's cooked, and then it becomes cold, so in general that's still edible. May not be ideal, but it's edible. Maybe it's somewhat comparable to a Michael Ben Drusai kind of edible, in that it's not what somebody who has a lot of time might prefer, but it's not raw. While if you have something like chicken soup, so then once it gets cold, it's basically not at all desirable in its cold form. And perhaps that's representative of a general distinction as well between solids and liquids. The question of, on some level, is it usable, is it edible when it is cooled down? So to illustrate this difference, and again, as Willick discusses, so for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva regarding ketchup. So how should we view ketchup? Is ketchup a solid or a liquid? And so ketchup in general poses its own challenges in life. It's, I think the word is pixotropic, the word that determines, that defines the texture of ketchup. And on the one hand, you pour it, but it pours slowly because of its thick consistency. So the word for that is thixotropic. So how should you view that in terms of its liquid solid state? So Rav Moshe says, you pour it, and it's held in a kli. If it's not held in a kli, you wouldn't be able to handle it because it's liquidy. So therefore, says Rav Moshe, it's a liquid. However, others disagree. There's a contemporary Sefer on the Shabbos written by two Machabrim together called the Sefer Orcha Shabbos. And the Orcha Shabbos, he maintains that ketchup, as we know, is usable cold. So it doesn't need cooking in order for it to be a useful liquid. And therefore, it's not subject to a prohibition of cooking. It's not subject to bishul under the terms of a bishul after bishul. Jonathan?
You eat it cold from the fridge, but what about if making the ketchup during the process, there's some sort of cooking of it?
Right, so then it was mevushal already.
Right.
Right? So now that it's cooled down...
It's solid.
Right, that's the point. That for the position of ein bishul achar bishul, that after it was originally created, so now once it's cooled down, it's still useful, as opposed to, let's say, soup, where once it's cooled down, it's essentially not of interest to us.
Maybe.
For all due respect to whatever family members may enjoy it that way, the minhag olam seems to be that they're not so interested in it. Similarly, so there is a discussion that the Magen Avraham maintains that if you have congealed gravy, so it's permissible to reheat that,
working off the premise, this seems to be his basic definition for these purposes, that you have sometimes items which take different forms, different temperatures. So should we define it as a liquid or a solid? So he basically works off the premise that what it is at room temperature is going to define it, meaning not necessarily that what it always is room temperature, but as far as I understand what he's saying is that if right now it's room temperature and this is where it's at, so then that's its definition. So therefore, he treats it like a solid. So the Aruch HaShabbos disagrees with that. Why?
You can figure out the Shitasa. Why does he disagree with that?
It's not edible.
It's not edible, right? What are you going to do with congealed gravy? That's pretty unappetizing. So to that, Rabbi Willig adds this page that if you leave it at room temperature without doing anything to it, it will eventually liquefy, and then it will be useful. So under those circumstances, that could be still considered useful. You don't have to cook it more. In order for it to become useful, you can just let nature take its course, and therefore that's essentially considered to be usable.
Hi. In my experience, if you leave like gravy out or something like that, even at room temperature, that's when it will congeal, if you leave it out.
So, okay. Does it congeal in the fridge?
Yeah.
When you put it into the fridge.
Right,
saying,
but if you leave
it
outside.
If you leave it out, it will congeal as well. I don't know if it liquefies at room temperature. I think
eventually, doesn't it?
I don't know.
Break down? Do some experiments.
I'm sure Willa did, actual experiments.
Yes, it's a big experiment. But definitely all experiments that involve gravy are always worth pursuing. However many steps we have to do, however much gravy must be tested, go through the process for the sake of science and Torah. That's what has to be done. All right. So one of the major issues also that Poskim talk about is what about if you have combinations? So you have something which is very often the case because rarely something is completely dry. Say, so if you have solids and liquids that are mixed in together, so how should we view that? Should we view that as a solid or as a liquid? Or
like soup that has like onions and stuff?
Well, that's something that you could consider, but what we're probably thinking about is something less like that, something more like a dish that has some liquid in it, that has something liquidy, a sauce on it, which soup is going to be defined as a soup unless it's an extremely thick soup, because usually the liquid will be the majority of it. But let's say you have a scenario where the liquid is the minority. So the solid part is clearly viewed as a solid and therefore subject to the heter of ein bishul achar bishul. But what about the liquid component of it? So here, so you find a basis lahakel up to about 49%. That was the view of the Menachos Kohen, that if anything less than half is liquid, so then that's acceptable. Other achronim had slightly different proportions, but even a significant minority is still acceptable. And the truth is that we could understand a couple different ways. Right? If we ask the question of why is it that we want to be machalik between liquids and solids vis-a-vis bishul achar bishul, so you can understand why a number of svaras might be relevant to be makel if the defining element is not the liquid component. First of all, the item itself presumably is edible in this cold form once it's essentially solid food, even if it has liquid on it that's now cold. So from this point that we're discussing today, the edibility standard, that itself does it. But the truth is other svaras are probably relevant as well, because the main improvement of the item has already taken place. If the sauce or whatever it is just viewed as secondary, is viewed as tofel to it, so you could understand also why that's not going to be subject to such a definition. And especially also the view that we discussed last week, that maybe the notion of bishul achar bishul by liquids is a chumrah. We say that really in the Ikar HaDin we say bishul achar bishul across the board. And it's just that we're machmir on liquids under certain circumstances, but not necessarily always. So if the liquid is the smaller part of what we're talking about, so then we could understand maybe why that's not going to define something as a liquid for these intents and purposes. There was also a machlokas between
this might have no relevance, but
it might.
I would not. But I would say it's like from a health of the brachos issue, like you never make a bracha on sauce, you know. So it's like tough to help.
Right. So the question is, so is that, you're right. So now let's think about it for a second. Does that have? So clearly, it's true that it is tough. Right. So in terms of how we relate to it, it's secondary. And in terms of why we're eating it, it's secondary. Right. So all of that is relevant to halachos brachos. But should that be definitive when it comes to bishul? Right. If we say that you're not allowed to cook things, so the fact that you're cooking something else at the same time that you're more interested in, so why should that make it okay? Right. So is the tafel ikur svar enough to do that? So maybe yes, maybe no. You know, if you want to say that it's all about an improvement, so then you could say that this is not what you're trying to improve. You're improving the majority part of it, and this just comes along for the ride, so that maybe that part isn't improved at all. This is not about, I got to put this into the oven so that the sauce will be perfect. You want to put this into the oven so that the food will be perfect. So from that perspective, maybe the ikur tafel svara does play a role. If you want to say the chumrah point, so there it plays a role with a different way that you say that it's just simply not what we're interested in, and therefore perhaps we don't extend the chumrah to the case where that's not what we're cooking. So whether or not the comparison to halachos brachos is relevant probably depends on what exactly is the focus, what's the basis for the distinction between solids and liquids. So there is a machlokas between the Magen Avraham and the Jager on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch about the following scenario. So let's say you're washing dishes. So you want to pour hot water onto the gravy that's stuck onto the dishes, the food that's stuck onto the dishes. So the Magen Avraham does not seem to think that that's a problem with bishul. And the Kiva Eger thought that that was very bishul. He thought that was more bishul than, let's say, if you were to take this solid food and put it next to, let's say, for example, the gravy that we discussed before was a topic of machlokas, whether the congealed gravy is subject to a prohibition of bishul or not. So let's say if you're going to put that near a heat source, then it's ultimately going to cook. So there, it says, with Kiva Eger, at least you're not really active in that. Once it happens, you're not doing anything. But here, you're pouring hot water onto this food, and it's going to then start the liquefying, and then you're going to keep pouring it on, you're going to be reheating it. So why should that be winter? So what's the Magen Avraham svara here, apparently, following the premise we've been working off of?
Doesn't really make it edible, but more and more.
Exactly, right? And this is already ois the achila stage, right? This is already at the stage where everything's being thrown out, everything's being cleaned off, so whatever improvement may take place is non-existent, really. And as I will emphasize, it's important to understand the terminology. You might say, well, okay, so you're not interested in cooking this liquid that's on the dishes, but shouldn't we say that's sikresha? Because it's happening inadvertently. So you'll say, all right, yeah, it's sikresha, but I don't really care about it. And I have no interest in this food being cooked. So therefore, that's called a sikresha delo nichale. So you'll say, all right, subsigration of lichale, but subsigration of lichale is usually prohibited midrabanan. This is actually the topic of, I think, spend any time this semester talking about subsigration, I don't remember. But it's worth always being on top of this terminology. And that if you have a subsigration, for you to be liable for subsigration, normally if you do action A, and action A will definitely bring about action B, so then you're theoretically liable for that. You're chayiv for that. But it has to be a psikresha denichale. It has to be a desirable consequence. A consequence that looked at by itself would be considered desirable.
So it's machlokas rishonim, whether that means it has to be actively desirable. So if you don't care about it, lo ichpas leh, that's not good enough. That's considered to be like lo nichaleh. Or is it the other way around, that if it's lo nichaleh, if you're not interested in it, that will get you off the hook, but otherwise you're on the hook. So then lo ichpas leh in the middle, if you don't care about it, that's a problem. So how do you view this? It's not bad for you necessarily that this food's being cooked, but you certainly don't have any interest in it. It's certainly at best lo ichpas leh, maybe it's lo nichaleh. So either way,
can you make, you're making a distinction between lo nichaleh and lo ichpas?
There is such a distinction.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the Rishonim have such a distinction that basically, just to take a minute to explain this, because this is a, especially we shouldn't spend the year learning Shabbos without talking about this, because this is such a crucial Shabbos topic. That, so you understand, there's a concept of davar shenu miskaven, right? That if you are not intending to do a certain action, action B is happening because of you, but you're not looking to do that, it just happens as an unintentional consequence. So that's a machlokas in the Gemara, but we paskin that you're potter for that. That's not your problem. However, to flip it, this goes back like a tennis match, just go back and forth a couple of times, that if you know for sure it's going to happen, that's what we call a psikresha, and then you are liable, that you can disconnect yourself from it if it was inadvertent and not guaranteed. Oh, we did talk about this a little bit, the new technology issue we talked about. So if you know it's for sure going to happen, so then you have to bear the responsibility that it's going to happen, even if that wasn't your intent. That's called the psik reisha. However, we know that there is a condition that for that to be true, flip it again, it has to be nichaleh. So the question, the achronim, and the question of Rishonim already, is that Rashi and Tosfos and others argue about, is what is that requirement of nichaleh? Is it that it's only considered your problem if you're happy about it? Or is it that if you're unhappy about it, then it's not your problem? So in other words, in the middle, if it's lo nichaleh, if you don't care one way or another, how do you classify that? Do you classify that as your problem because you would have been off the hook if you're unhappy, but you're not unhappy, you just don't care? Or do we say, no, that it's not your problem because it's only your problem if you're happy? If you don't care, then you're not happy. So that's itself subject to a machlokas, which could be theoretically relevant here. Except, as Willig emphasizes, none of that's relevant here. Why? Because we're not simply saying that this is a situation of psik reisha d'lo nichaleh, which we paskin, even if it's lo nichaleh mamish, would probably be an issa d'rabbanan. There was a view in the Rishon, the Aruch, that psik reisha nichaleh is mutter completely. And we sometimes bring that in with other factors to rely on when there are other issues at play. But by itself, if there's no other compounding factors, we usually machmir to assume that segregation of the nichaleh is also midrabanan. So that would have been a problem here. Except, the issue is not that it's a segregation of the nichaleh, it's that the malacha isn't happening at all. That if the issue is that bishul means there's some kind of an improvement, and if this is essentially not improvable because it's garbage already, so it's not a candidate for that kind of improvement. So therefore, that's a working assumption that this schmutz essentially on the plates that's not going to be edible no matter what is not going to be subject to this type of improvement by the hot water running over it. So this standard of edibility is one that you find coming up a few other places, just to mention a few other examples, and we'll try to talk about some Pesach things in a few minutes. So you find it also, for example, a Shari Tshuva, which was on the Marmar Kolmos, you had a chance to see, that the Shari Tshuva, the bottom of the Shulchan Aruch, the Shari Tshuva writes that if you pour hot water onto liquefied sugar, so the sugar has become liquid. So you might say, okay, so we should treat that as a liquid, and therefore it should be subject to a problem of bishul. But there he's mako. Why is he mako? Again, presumably, because
the sugar was usable for its purpose and in solid form. And the fact that it may have liquefied now doesn't make it liquid for the purposes of Bishul, because essentially it's not something that needs the cooking to make it usable. Hi.
Would you say that there's some improvement there now that it's a liquid, that it's easier to dissolve in another liquid, let's say, or something like that? There is
so, right, so it doesn't seem to be the standard that it's improved. And it seems to be that once it becomes edible, so then we could view it like food, right? Because food is improved with additional cooking. Food that's been cooled off, like we said, we would rather have it heated up if possible. But at least from a Michael Ben Josai kind of perspective, not that it's the same thing as Michael Ben Josai, just the perspective of what would we deal with, what would we be okay with if we were in a rush. So if you're being chased, so that's acceptable. So too, it's acceptable here. Question of whether it's improved. Yeah, it's improved, but solids are improved also by cooking. But if they're at a stage where they're already edible, so then they're subject to this leniency of Ein Bishul Acher Bishul.
At least according to the Rambam, raw vegetables, let's say, that can be eaten raw are solid, and we still say they're special when you eat them off. So it would seem to apply to sugar as well. It's edible raw, but there's apparently no bishul here. So I thought maybe it had to do with improvement. Maybe you say
right, the difference is that to initially cook it, to change it from one point to the next. And so that would be a problem of the Rambam's, and the Shulchan Aruch follows the Rambam, his view of Bishul in the first place. But the kula of Ein Bishul Acher Bishul, that once it's reached a certain level of cooking, and then it's cooled down, so then cooking it again is not an extra prohibition, so then that can suffice with a standard of it's usable.
Oh, I thought it was here saying that you can heat up, you can put hot water into sugar, the chlam. You can.
Yeah, you can, because the sugar is cooked already. But so it's subject to the rule of Ein Bishul Acher Bishul.
What sugar is cooked already?
Well, if the sugar has been cooked, if the sugar has already been, let's say.
Well, let's say it's not. Let's say you just have sugar and in a cup, and you want to put hot water in the cup.
Yeah. So then you have another possibility that it's a spice, and that's also not subject to rules of cooking. But here, that the idea that it may have turned into a liquid. So that doesn't necessarily cause any problems because it was just as usable beforehand. So it doesn't need the liquidification for it to become useful. Hi.
And so you talked about this earlier. Water in general is usable without being heated up. So why is there a superficial by just regular cup of water?
Right, so we did talk about that a little bit, just to quickly recap the highlights of it. So it could be that water is subject to a different definition, that maybe, therefore, it doesn't have the same set of rules. Or we also discussed the Magen Avraham's understanding that he doesn't seem to think that it's as usable as it is when it's cold, which is interesting. It's not necessarily how we relate to it nowadays. But he also suggests the possibility that maybe you're only chayav for water, which is a big chiddush. You're only chayav for water when it's used for cleaning or something like that, and you need it to be hot. But that for drinking purposes, where you would be okay with it when it's cold, then taka, if you cooked it for drinking purposes, you wouldn't be chayav. That's a pretty big chiddush. So who's going to go first? Okay.
Yeah, just to clarify, you might have also, speaking about sauce, so like if you want to warm up in the warming jar on Shabbos day, like chicken that was cooked in sauce, so you can't do that, right?
Well, maybe you can if the sauce is a minority of it, if the sauce is a secondary.
So what's obviously it's always going to be a minority compared to the
Well,
meat.
No, if it's soup already, something like that, it doesn't necessarily always constitute a minority.
If you have chicken that was cooked in sauce, you could have a ton of sauce in there, but you're allowed to.
So you'd have to have a ton plus an ounce of, that's a lot of meat. I'm coming over to your house for dinner. 2,001 pounds of meat.
Okay, so I'm saying is that, meaning if you're warming up chicken is obviously what you're warming it up for. You want the chicken. So is it okay if there's a lot of sauce?
So if the sauce is less than 50%, or others have a little bit of a different measurement, but if it's a minority, that's even if it's a significant minority, but that's not what you're going for. And then that helps. So there is an interesting reversal of this. So the Aruch HaShulchan maintains that if you're going to pour hot water directly over coffee grinds or tea leaves, because even if they've been cooked before, So then, that's still subject to a prohibition of bishop.
So why should that be? There were a couple who were. So here, apparently the understanding is, again, that our standard is edibility. So since you can't do anything with these tea leaves or these coffee grinds, even though they're essentially solid in composition, but they become edible through being cooked, so therefore they're going to be viewed as a liquid from that perspective. And the Willig maintains that this is not true for instant coffee or instant tea, because those, see, as research and experimentation has shown, it is also used to make iced coffee and iced tea. So therefore, it's equally valuable, or it's at least significantly valuable, even in cold form. You can use it as a flavoring for water and drink it with cold water and drink it straight that way, so it doesn't need to be cooked in order to be usable. So he sees that as the opposite kind of category from what the Aruch HaShulchan is talking about.
So as far as that, since it doesn't need hot water, it can be used, cold water can be added to instant coffee, let's say?
Yeah, that they say.
It's not considered cooking when you use hot water?
Yeah, you have two things. You have two things in play. First of all, that's cooked before, so you theoretically should have been able to say ein bishul acher bishul. But the Aruch HaShulchan's point is that even though it was cooked before, but it's viewed like a liquid, when we don't have the kula of ein bishul acher bishul. So why is it viewed like a liquid? It's solid. So it's viewed like a liquid because if the definition of liquids versus solids is that liquids can't be used in their uncooked form, and solids can. So here, the coffee grinds don't have any value in their uncooked form, so it's through cooking them that they're able to become usable. So it's interesting. So this just provides us with a few illustrations of this whole possible distinction. So we've seen that liquids may be differentiated from solids for a couple reasons. Maybe in their whole prohibition of cooking in the first place, maybe in terms of the question of whether or not there is a physical change, whether perhaps different liquids should be differentiated from each other. So today, we focus basically on this question of the edibility standard, that maybe there's a difference for that reason. Solids can be edible after they've cooled down, even if it's not great, and soups, for most of us, things like that, are not edible in their cold form. So we talked about some nafkaminas in that, such as the question of ketchup, which we saw was a machlokas, the Igros Moshe, and the Orach HaShabbos, the question of the Magen Avraham's heter of this congealed gravy, which seems to show that room temperature is the standard, and the Orach HaShabbos disagreeing because taka, the congealed gravy, is inedible and useless, and Willig's position that it will eventually liquefy in that position and therefore is useful. The question that Wesley just asked about now, about a mixture of solids and liquids, and how, as long as it's a majority of solids, seems to be a basis. Lahakim, we talked about various svaras to look at that. The machlokas, the Magen Avraham and Rabbi Akiva Eiger, about pouring hot water on the food that's on dirty dishes. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger is concerned that that's going to end up cooking liquids, and apparently the Magen Avraham's position is that it's inedible that way, and therefore it's not even in Shtikresha. Dolnichale, it's not the malacha at all. The Shari Tshuva's heter for liquefied salt, and the Aruch HaShulchan's chumrah about tea and coffee, that it's not edible in that form, and therefore it would be subject to bishul acher bishul. Then there was a point about how this would be true for instant tea or coffee, because that also equals iced tea and coffee, and therefore is edible in that form. All right, so let's try to squeeze a few words about Pesach in the time we have left today, and tomorrow we'll try to go back to bishul, we'll go back and forth. One of the points, because we did Hilchos Chanukah earlier in the year, so in order to try to have an ongoing theme, so we mentioned,
synergy.
A little bit of synergy, right, and somewhat of an ongoing theme between what we talked about Chanukah time, or whole first semester, which was Chanukah time for us, and to draw on that in the Hilchos Pesach discussion. So what's the biggest link between Hanukkah and Pesach, besides being 8 days long? Okay, which is a subset of something else. Persume Nisa, right? So I want to talk a little bit about Persume Nisa. Probably later in the week I'll say more about it, but just to first give a little bit of a hafdama to that. So what's the mitzvah of Pesach that is most Persume Nisa oriented? And that subjects the rule of Afein Hayuvo Soneis? What did you say?
Matzah,
interesting. I was thinking Delicosos. Right, matzah is not because of Afein Hayuvo Soneis. Matzah, women are obligated in matzah equally to men. But there, that's for a different reason. It's not because of Afein. It's because of something very similar to Kiddush. I think we talked about that a little bit sometime this year. I don't remember why it came up. But women are, maybe it didn't come up, maybe making that up. But in any event, so when it comes to Kiddush, men and women are equally obligated on a level in HaTorah because there is a Hekesh. The Gemara Brachas in the Chaf Medeis says that there is essentially a unique Hekesh. That's the only time in the Torah that this kind of Hekesh applies. And Zachar B'Shavar, the Dibor Echad, and Amro, that even though the Psukim are nowhere near each other, there are several Svarim apart. But in Metzias, they were said in one breath, so therefore it's creating a connection between Zohar and Shomer. So therefore, it says the Gemara, Kol Sheyeshno B'Schira, Yeshno B'Shmira. Whoever is subject to the mitzvah of, I said the other way around, Sheyeshno B'Shmira, Yeshno B'Schira, whoever is subject to Shmira Shabbos, which means not doing Malachos, is therefore subject to Zechira Shabbos. It's not focus what that means, but it seems to me at least some basic form of Kiddush. So therefore, women are obligated in the Torah. It's understood to be the same obligation. So when it comes to matzah, you have a very similar type of drasha, but there's also a hekesh there as well. That just like kiddush, matzah should have been perceived as a mitzvah saseh shad van grama. It's a positive mitzvah that's performed in a limited time frame. But it's excluded from that category because of this hekesh that calls Yeshno v'bal tochel chametz, Yeshno v'achilas matzah. Whoever is subject to the prohibition of eating chametz on Pesach, which is the rules I say, so it certainly applies to men and women equally. So therefore, whoever is subject to that prohibition also has an obligation of matzah, which has some interesting applications and some interesting nafkaminas. There's a whole discussion some of the Achronim have that, let's say, somebody has an exemption from matzah for whatever reason, so would that somehow flip back on his Isser of Chametz? That's a different discussion. But what I want to focus on first is that, therefore, so when it comes to matzah, it's not Afein Hayuvo Soneis that is operative, which could be for a number of reasons anyway. There's a position many of the Rishonim have. Not all the Rishonim, but many of the Rishonim, and some of them the Balei HaTosfos, a little more prominent, that Afein Hayuvo Soneis is only relevant to mitzvahs derabbanan. Maybe it's only relevant on a level midrabbanan. But in any event, that does not seem like it would suffice to create a chiyuv deraisa when it comes to matzah for one or the other reasons. And it's also an interesting question, hashkafically, whether matzah should be perceived as something that's there in Mishum Hanes. As a comment of Eitzalevi has in his commentary on Chumash, that it's the other way around, that the Torah's intent was always to obligate us in matzah, and that the Tzias Mitzrayim was brought about in such a way so that matzah would be understood in that framework, which is a little bit of an esoteric comment, but we know that we have the tradition that Avraham Avinu was eating matzah long before Yetzias Mitzrayim. So what exactly is the relationship between matzah and Yetzias Mitzrayim is itself an interesting question. But in any event, that wasn't what I was looking for today. The mitzvah midrabbanan that is really patterned after the Neis and that's there for the purposes of Persume Nisa is the mitzvah of Dalakosos. Dalakosos, therefore, is kind of distinct Pesach night, because a lot of the things that we do are d'oraisa, at least in origin. Some of them are not d'oraisa today, but are d'oraisa, at least we call ikaro d'oraisa, that they are d'rabbanan versions of what is in the Chumash. But the Dalakosos essentially seems like it's completely an invention mid'rabbanan, But the Yerushalmi does link it, at least in some way, to Pesukim in Parshas Vayera. What am I talking about? That one possible inspiration for Dalakoso, says the Gemara, is the Arba Lashonos of Gula, the four expressions, the four verbs of redemption that we find in the beginning of Parshas Vayera, Bosesi, Vitzalti, Degalti, Lagati, that is on some level the inspiration for the Dalakoso. So that prompts a question, kind of a fundamental question you could ask. What exactly is the nature of the obligation of Dalakosos? This is a question that the Brisker Rav asks, and we'll say from the Rambam. We're going to say it a little bit differently than he says it, but just note that he asks a very similar question, a very similar analysis, that one could maintain like this. One could say that the mitzvah of Dalakosos, the institution that Chazal put for the purposes of pursuing Nisa, is to have a drink. That essentially Chazal said we should commemorate the Geula with a drink of wine. So how does that become four? So okay, so that's what this statement the Yerushalmi is telling us, that four is symbolic of four Lashonos of Geula. And therefore, we should have four cups of this wine in order to make that point. So we should drink in order to display cheres, in order to symbolize the liberation. And times four because of this theme of the Dalal Lashonos of Gula. Some of the Rishonim actually had a question, which I could have related to a little bit more. I said, maybe we should have had four pieces of meat on Seder night. Maybe that would have been an equally effective way of making this point. I would have preferred that. So others suggest that the symbolism of wine is that it is transformative. It takes you from one stage to the next. And as the Ramban understands, that these four Lashonos of Geula, it's not the synonyms, and not four ways of saying the same thing. They represent stages. So therefore, we want to symbolize going from one stage to the next. So, therefore, wine is what takes us from one point to the next point, and that's where we get Dalal Lashonos of Geula and four cups of wine. So that's one way to look at things. And you could say that Chazal instituted a mitzvah to drink, and times four because of the imagery of the Dalal Lashonos of Geula. Alternatively, you could say that it's not about that at all. And you could say that the notion of the kosos is that it's there to represent the idea that we have of a brach al hakos. That we know that very often when we have a mitzvah that is a bracha, or it's a recitation, it's just words, so we grant that process a little more chashivas by reciting it over a cup of wine. We have a concept of a brach al hakos. So perhaps the notion Pesach night is that all year round we have a kos sometimes and sometimes we don't. Right? Sometimes we bench all our kos and sometimes we don't worry about it so much. So the kos maybe is there, it isn't there. But Pesach night, Chazal insisted that the relevant brachos be recited al hakos. And the idea being, presumably, that being able to recite a bracha al hakos is also a simon of, if not chayr, is a simon of being in good shape in general. And the Gemara says in brachos that in terms of the evolution of the mitzvah of Havdalah, that at first they had an institution of Havdalah al hakos, and then when the Jews couldn't afford wine, they were makel, they could just make Havdalah in tefillah. And then Chazru v'Hashiru, then once the Jews were able to afford wine again because they became wealthy, so then we went back to what we have today, where there is Havdalah in Tefillah and Al HaKos. So it sounds like being able to make a bracha Al HaKos is an indication of being in good shape, of being royal, of being well off. So if the notion is that Pesach night, we want to have that mentality that we're all Hashirim, that we're all well off, so then perhaps the notion of a bracha al hakos reflects that and becomes mandatory Pesach night, even if it isn't always the case. So maybe the notion is then that it's a bracha on a kos. And if that's the idea, so where do you get four from? You get four, presumably, from the fact that there are four such mitzvot over the course of the Seder. All right, what do we have? We have Kiddush. We have Haggadah, Magid. We have Halal at the end, and before Halal, you have Birchas Hamazon. So maybe you have four mitzvot of speech over the course of the night. And Chazal insisted that each one of those four, Kiddush, Magid, Birchas Hamazon, and Halal, should be done on Halakos. So that gives us two different models to understand what's going on here. Two different conceptions of why it is that bracha, why we have a concept of Dalet Kosos over the course of the Seder, might be because the mitzvah to drink times four, or maybe it's a mitzvah to make the brachos and the other verbal mitzvahs over the course of the night over a kos. So what nafkamina would that have? Right, can you think of a difference it might make? Does this affect the halach at all, whether we say it one way or another? Jonathan?
You can have one person have a kos for everyone.
Ah, so it sounds like one possible, this is one of the issues that the Brisker Rav discusses as a possible nafkamina, is should we apply the principle of Shemei Ka'on? The Tosis, the beginning of the 10th parak of Pesachim, seems to work off the premise that Shemei Ka'on is a possibility. That maybe we could have a scenario, it would save a lot of money, right? Let's say you have a large family or a large assemblage. Let's say you have 10 people in the room. So that's 40 cups of wine times two, that's 80 cups of wine. That could be very expensive. And that could really set somebody back. So why don't we just have, just the balabas should have four cups of wine and everyone should listen to him. So we'll save 90% of the expenses. So, why shouldn't that work? Because we do have such a plan by Kiddush every Friday night. Right? That we have one person make Kiddush, usually there are different practices, but it's very common to see that you'll have one individual make Kiddush, and he'll be the only one who will have a full cup of wine.
Especially for benching.
Yeah. Right, especially for benching, for sure. That's the way, that's the most you ever see, right, is that there should be one cup of wine. But even for Kiddush, so that's the common practice. You know, theoretically, people listening may choose to make their own Kiddush or may have their own full kos. Or more common, they'll have a little bit just to drink, but they won't necessarily have a full kos. So generally, we suffice with one cup of wine for the balabas. So let's have the same plan here. Let's have the balabas drink all the dalet kosos, and Shemei Ka'ona will be effective for everyone else. So that seems to be a premise of Tosfos. And the Rambam perhaps disagrees because the Rambam does not acknowledge any venue of Shemei Ka'ona when talking about the obligation of Dalet Kosos. Could be because no one asked him, but he doesn't entertain that as a possible way of doing things. So as the Brisker Rav suggests, right, this could be the issue, that the question might be, what's the mitzvah of the Dalet Kosos? That if the mitzvah is to drink, so then Shemei Ka'ona doesn't come into the conversation. Right? Shemei Ka'ona, we know, doesn't apply by every mitzvah in the Torah. It applies only by mitzvahs that are speech-oriented, where it makes sense, where I could listen to somebody else talking. But the mitzvah is not about speech, so where do you have a discussion of Shemei Ka'ona? That's like saying that instead of eating matzah, you could listen to the crunch of the guy next to you, and Shemei Ka'ona, it'll be as if you ate matzah. Which is increasingly tempting when the shiurim keep going up. And so maybe that'll save a lot of matzah too. So that doesn't seem to work. Right? No one would think it works, because clearly that's not a venue for Shemei Ka'ona. So if the mitzvah is drinking, so then it doesn't really get off the ground. But if the idea is bracha hakos, so then we have seen that. We've seen that bracha hakos, we don't require that everyone who's listening to the bracha or everyone who's being yotzei with the bracha has the kos. And so I pointed out, certainly with bracha samazin, you never see that. But even with Kiddush, so it's generally not the practice that the one actually making the bracha can
have the coast, and everyone who's listening
doesn't necessarily have to have them. So if this is the machlokus between the Rambam and Tosfos, so then perhaps it could reflect such a difference. It's important to Hosafa, and this is going to be especially relevant as we expand the focus on Persumenis in general. So it is possible, as some of the Acharonim point out, there's a tshuva about this, and the tshuva is his Oris tshuva, that Tosfos probably doesn't really think that Shemaya Ka'oner works for Dalek Tosfos. And if you read the Tosfos in their Maskana, they don't really endorse Shemaya Ka'oner for Dalek Tosfos. But it could be that Tosfos is coming to say something else. That the context of Tosfos is the Mishnah. We have the first Mishnah in the 10th Perek of Pesachim, where the Mishnah tells us a Chiddush, which is relevant to our broader theme of Persumei Nisa, that the Mishnah states that afilu ani halokeach mehatamchui, that if you have somebody who is taking money from the soup kitchen, who needs help from communal funds because he doesn't have enough to pay for meals. So the Mishnah says, so not only should he accept staka so that he can buy food, but he has to also make sure that he can do dalek kosos. So lo yifchos lo midalek kosos shalyayin, he has to also ask for dalek kosos. And this, as the Magen Mishnah in Halachas Chanukah points out, that this seems to be the basis for the din. I don't remember if we actually got up to it at all in Halachas Chanukah, or if we were leaving it for this discussion. It's possible. But that this is the marker for the din that you find in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch when it comes to Ne'eres Chanukah. That the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch both say that if somebody can't afford Chanukah candles, Shoal al psachim, amocher is ksuso, you go knocking on doors, you sell your clothes, you do whatever you can in order to be able to afford to light Hanukkah candles. And everyone asks, well, that's not normally the din. The Gemara says in Ksubas that if somebody is not able to afford a mitzvah that costs more than a fifth, so then he doesn't have to do it. Just to be accurate, the Gemara doesn't say that in Ksubas. What the Gemara says in Ksubas is that when it comes to staka, we have a limit of 1/5. And the Ramah extends that idea that you find the Hilchos Tzedakah to positive mitzvahs in general, and that the mitzvahs I say, you're not obligated to do, it's going to cost you more than a fifth of your money. So how come that's not the rule here? So if you can't afford Chanukah candles, if you can't afford dalek kosos, so you're potter. What do you mean you have to go begging, you have to ask for help, you have to ask for tzedakah? You're off the hook. So the Magen Mishnah points to this Mishnah about dalek kosos and says, oh, you see from here that the rule is, when it comes to Persumei Nisa, so one is obligated to go to great lengths, even if you can't afford it, you have to make sure to perform the mitzvah. So that doesn't really answer the question, it just recategorizes it. And it says, so you have these dinim, Ne'eres Chanukah, dalek kosos, to whatever extent such a svara is relevant to Hilchos Megillah. So they're all dinim d'rabbanan. So how does it explain it to say, okay, they're all Persumei Nisa, so therefore you have to go above and beyond, but we still have to explain why that's true. So Shechter often quotes from Rav Soloveitchik that the Rav understood the idea of Persumei Nisa as a whole, that Persumei Nisa is a type of tefillah. That it's a way of saying, God, you've given us miracles in the past. We'd like some more miracles. Please continue, keep them coming. So, therefore, we are mefarsim the miracles that we've had. So, if that's the idea, that it's a way of asking for more miracles, so essentially we want God to go outside of his budget, kaviyachol. Normally, he runs the world al pi derech hateva, and we want him to take a different step beyond that. So it's a little bit incongruous if we say we want extraordinary treatment, and in order to make that point, we have allotted exactly 19.9% of our budget, not one cent over. So it doesn't really send the right message. That if we really are asking for above and beyond kind of treatment, so then we have to show that we're also ready to go above and beyond the normal requirements. The Avnei Nezer had a whole different approach, which you could talk about for a long time, but we'll just mention it briefly here. The Avnei Nezer understood that the notion of Persumei Nisa is different, because essentially it's viewed like a benadam l'chayir. That essentially, even though it's really a benadam l'makom, but it requires communication and interaction. And therefore, when it comes to mitzvahs benadam l'chaveiro, so we have a different set of rules, because the notion of anus, let's say, that you're off the hook if you can't accomplish something, if it's impossible, so that works between you and God. God can say, listen, I know you tried, I know you wanted to do it, so you couldn't, so I'll credit you as if you did. But that doesn't work when you're dealing with human beings. They can't read your mind. They don't know what you want to do. They only know what benefit they actually have. So therefore, when it comes to benad mechavero, you can't rely on these kinds of excuses. So the Avinezer understood that Persumanisa has the same issue, that it's about communicating with other people, and therefore that kind of communication requires that it actually happen. Hi.
Did you just say that for the 1/5 rule doesn't apply for benad mechavero?
Basically, that's what...
Is it Mars case benad mechavero?
Because of stucco.
Yeah.
Right, so the question is, stucco becomes, when it's writ large, becomes a different type of calculation. That the idea that stucco by itself is a sliding scale kind of obligation. But if the mitzvah was more absolute, you know, it's quite in terms of all or nothing kind of things, let's say you have one individual who's about to collapse because he doesn't have any food. So he can't say, well, all right, listen, you mean well, I know you'd like to give me, so I'll be okay and I'll walk away and I'll be fine. It's not going to work. So there becomes a greater need that specific goal actually take place. So in that framework, so the Avinezer says that Persumanisa has to actually happen, and that becomes a priority that you don't necessarily find by other things. So this could also explain, this is so, to talk about Persumanisa more generally for a second. So this is an important principle in general in terms of time management and things like that, that when it comes to Megillah, so Megillah is a little bit less subject to this discussion because it generally doesn't cost money. You know, if you're nowhere near a Megillah, so then you'll have to figure out how to obtain one, but for most of us, to fulfill the mitzvah of Megillah, so it's not a money issue, it doesn't cost anything. But you have other considerations. So the Mishnah in Daf Gimel of Megillah says that Mikra Megillah is Doche the Avod in the Beis HaMikdash. So a lot of the Rishonim say, how could that be? That the Avod in the Beis HaMikdash is Daraisa, and Megillah is Darabana. So a lot of the Rishonim say, yes, that's true. It doesn't mean that if you can only do one, you'll do Megillah. Because if you only do one of them, you'll do the Avodah, that's Daraisa. It means that we do the Megillah before the Avodah, and that gives it a certain level of publicity, a certain level of Persumanisa, and significant for that reason. But there is a minority view on the Rishon that yes, if you could only choose one mitzvah, you would do Megillah rather than the Avodah. So based on the other Nezer's Yesod, you could understand it. You could say that yes, Avodah is Daraisa, but Anas Rachmana Patre, if it's impossible for you to do two things at once, so God could say, alright, I credit you with what you want to do. But the Megillah is Persumanisa, so that has to actually happen. Which is important to emphasize in terms of how we make decisions in life. It's not to say that Megillah is more important. Daraisa presumably is still more important than a Darabana. But in terms of urgency, there's a greater urgency to the Megillah because Avodah can rely on Anas Rachmana Patre, and the Megillah doesn't have that avenue. Well, it's an interesting application of that idea. Just kind of highlights the fact that we don't always make decisions based only on importance. There are other considerations as well. So here you find that here too. And maybe that could explain why Megillah might outweigh the Avodah because of this Persumanisa quality, which is not a chumrah in the sense of severity. It's a chumrah in the sense that it's urgent because it can't be accomplished any other way. So based on all of that, so it could be that when Tosfos asked the question about let's let the Balabas have the set of Dalet Kosos and no one else has to have it, Tosfos wasn't necessarily saying that that's all Dalet Kosos requires. That Dalet Kosos could be done just as happily with one set in Shemei Kaona, and there's no value at all to everyone having their own set. Tosfos never thought that. What Tosfos was saying is that really, if a person can't afford kosos, you should be pater. If it's out of your budget, you should be off hook. So the Mishnah says, no, for Shemitah, you have to have it. So to that, Tosfos might be saying, okay, but one set can accomplish the Pursuma Nisa. That if you have in the room a set of Dalakosos, everyone in the room is exposed to the same Dalakosos they would be if they had their own. So maybe that should take the edge off, essentially. That the Chumrah that comes from Pursuma Nisa, that will be addressed by having one set per household. And then it reverts to a normal din. So then, yes, you still really need Dalakosos, but it doesn't have the same extra Chumrah that comes because of Pursuma Nisa. And then we could say, if you can't afford it, so then you should be off the hook, and one set per household should suffice. So it's possible that Tosfos is not necessarily maintaining that Shemei Kaona is an equal, wonderful venue for Dalakosos, but just in terms of the whole mechanism between Pursuma Nisa and other obligations, that one set is enough, and presumably the bare bones of that is because, yes, they're understanding Shemei Kaona as at least possible, because it is a mitzvah bracha lakos, but not that that's necessarily going to accomplish everything that the Dalakosos are meant to accomplish. And that Mishnah, by the way, is the source of the famous story, I'm sure you've all heard. It's one of the things they teach you in rabbi school, so in honor of the Chag HaSmichah, so I'll mention this story, that the Beis HaLevi was asked by a woman who said she couldn't afford wine for the Seder, so the question came up, can she use milk? Which sounds a little funny, who would think milk had anything to do with wine, but the Gemara does compare them, because milk makes you drowsy, so maybe it's a little bit intoxicating. So her question was, maybe she could use milk for the Dalakosos. So basically, he said to her, no, you can't use milk, you have to use wine, and I'll give you tzedakah. In the kind where it says in the Mishnah, that to take from tzedakah for Dalakosos, I'll give you tzedakah for the wine. So the students saw that the money that he gave was more than the cost of wine. So they said, Rebbe, why'd you give her so much money? So his point was, right, that was the point.
She has other expenses, obviously. She's right. Super, she
if she's having milk for the Seder, then she's obviously not having meat.
Right, it's like the Rita Round would point out, right, that if she doesn't, she's planning on having milk, so then she's having a part of Seder, so clearly it's not just the wine, right? She's going to have to bench, and it's also, that would be a very complicated Seder. So, can you imagine that? Anyone have two meals, Pesach night. Anyway, so, and it, apparently she couldn't afford meat either, so the Beis HaLevi was supplying that. So the moral of the story is not just that you have to ask for tzedakah for Dalakosos, but that you have to be able to see the question that's not being asked, the question behind the question, and that seems to be an important lesson for aspiring rabbis as well. All right, so there's more to say about that. So again, tomorrow we'll try to probably also do the same two-track thing. We'll try to advance a little bit in visual and maybe say a few more points about this topic as we go on. Who wants to daven for us? Daven.